Hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard. That's why when it comes to hard work, nothing works harder than a Chevy Silverado, the official truck partner of the Chicago Bears. Check out a new Silverado at ChevyDriveChicago.com.
Morning, Chicagoland. It's Dave Player on 720 WGN. So our traditional image of Chicago is a gritty metropolis carved into ethically defined enclaves where the game of machine politics overshadows its end. It's such a powerful shaper of the city's identity that many of its closest observers fail to notice that a new Chicago has emerged over the past two decades. Author Larry Bennett and his book, Third City, Chicago and American Urbanism, tackles some of our more commonly held ideas about the Windy City, inherited by such icons as Theodore Dreiser, Carl Sandburg, Daniel Burnham, Robert Park, and Mike Ryko, and with the goal of better understanding Chicago as it is now, and that's the Third City. Larry, welcome to the program, and good morning to you.
It's great to be on.
You know, you start off by telling the stories of early Chicago and that Chicago is a self-conscious city. Explain that.
Well, I mean that at least in a couple of ways and probably far more than two. In one sense, it's the idea that a lot of Chicagoans carry around of us being the second city. There's New York, and of course these days there's also Los Angeles. But certainly it's this sense that ours is a city which has to live up to the reputation of other cities.
So true.
And then the other idea that I spend quite a bit of time in the early sections of the book discussing is that Chicago is a city that has been written about by a variety of people, sociologists, novelists, journalists. And so it's a city in which if you live here, you have a sense of place because you are in a neighborhood and you have friends and you have particular hangouts that you go to. But most of us have read about Chicago, and there's a section in the book that deals with the novels of Sarah Paretsky, which is a fun source of reading about the city for people, and Sarah has a particular take on the city. If you are a journalist and you sort of take seriously the development of the city over time, you have read Mike Ryko, and Ryko had his particular take on the city. And so the self-consciousness is both something that people have who live here, but it's also something that you just take in because you've read about the city from other voices.
Fascinating story early on about Robert Park in the University of Chicago's Department of Sociology and his viewpoint of the city.
Well, Robert Park was a fascinating figure. He was born during the Civil War. He spent the first 10 years of his professional career as a journalist in a number of cities around the United States. He decided that he wanted to understand society in a deeper way. He earned a PhD in Germany. He comes back to the United States and actually becomes the publicist for the Tuskegee Institute, Booker T. Washington's academic institution in the Deep South. He only comes to the University of Chicago in the sociology department when he's 50 years old. He's had a bundle of experiences beforehand, and then over the next 20 years essentially defines an approach to doing urban research and studying cities, which has a tremendous impact, not just in Chicago, but around the world.
And Park called us a mosaic of little worlds. You know, we're a city of neighborhoods. I mean, that's kind of how we're defined.
And yet all cities are cities of neighborhoods. And so in terms of this notion of self-consciousness that we've been talking about, one of the things that I try to explore in the book is why has Chicago in particular claimed itself to be the city of neighborhoods? And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that our history is it's a problematic history. Neighborhoods are good things, generally speaking. And yet neighborhoods have been one of the ways in which people who aren't like ourselves have been prohibited from joining us. Neighborhood succession, the post-war process of racial change in the city, and the tremendous political conflicts that emerged in the 1950s and the 1960s as many neighborhoods changed on the South and West Side. Park was there at the beginning of this and defined a framework for looking at it, and then millions of people have lived that experience in subsequent decades.
There are many plans of Chicago, per se, that you talk about, Larry, in the book. And it started with Daniel Burnham's 1909 plan of Chicago. But you also talk about the development plan for the central area in Chicago in 1958, another one in 2003. Give us a little insight on how these plans in their own way have shaped the city over the last century.
Well, each of these plans has a sense of the city that exists as the people who are working on the process of putting these documents together. During that time, they have a sense of the reality of the city, or what I call the empirical city in the book. They also have a vision of what they want the city to become. And again, I think from the standpoint of most Chicagoans, the Burnham Plan, or as it's formerly known, the Plan of Chicago, is a Bible-like document.
Sure.
In which there is the sense that this great figure sort of came down from the mountain and he projected a city which was going to be gloriously symmetrical and aesthetically pleasing. These subsequent plans have a very different kind of place, I think, in people's sense of the city. For example, the development plan for the central area of Chicago in 1957, virtually no one knows about. It was a much different kind of affair in the sense that it wasn't publicized subsequently in the same way. There hadn't been the same kind of process in which a lot of consultation with elites around the city had been involved. It was a tremendously important document, though, in the particular sense that it represented the way in which the city government and the business elite of the city in the early post-war World War II period, after Richard J. Daley had become mayor, began to focus on how a new city was going to be created. And so when you look at the development plan for the central area, you see this very modernistic, this very clean Chicago, a city that's in many ways very at odds with the city that actually existed at the time, but it was their normative vision of what they wanted the city to become. And this more recent central area plan from the early 2000 and aughts, I think in many ways functions in the same way. The thing that is striking about it is that the central portion of the city has become much larger in a physical sense. So it's pushed out to the near west side, into the near south side. And it was a confident document developed at a time in Richard M. Daley's administration in which a lot of things seemed to be going right for the city. I think the thing that is interesting now, only a decade past the development of that document, is that a lot of the optimism that's built into its vision of the city seems to have evaporated.
Well, we're talking to author Larry Bennett and his fascinating book, The Third City, and there's more after the news next on 720 WGN. Morning, Chicagoland, it's Dave Player on 720 WGN, and we're talking to author Larry Bennett and his book, The Third City. Larry, you know, you talked a little bit about the first Mayor Daley. You talk about a city utterly transformed by the top-to-bottom reconstruction of public housing developments and the ambitious provision of public works like Millennium Park, a work in progress spearheaded by Richard M. Daley. Was Daley the re-embodiment of the old Daley?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. As he aged, he began to look a little bit like his father, and he, I think, always sounded like his father.
But that's where the similarities ended, really.
Well, I think so. I think that the son was much better traveled and a more cosmopolitan person. I think that he intuitively recognized that the early post-war Chicago of the 1950s and the 1960s had passed. The industrial economy that had really driven Chicago since the late 19th century was in substantial transition. And I think that his great insight as mayor was that he was attempting to steer Chicago in the direction of becoming the kind of global city that would allow its population to once again continue to grow, that would represent a place in which there was opportunities for various kinds of entrepreneurial and creative development. And he was a mayor who understood that the city had advantages from its past, such as its museums and such some of its physical infrastructure, which could really be turned in the direction for a progressive future for the city. Now, I think that there were also some missing elements in this recipe, but his sense of the city was very much one in which Chicago needs to change. I think his father was much more of a conservator. He was attempting to retain a kind of Chicago that he had grown up in, and he was attempting to retain the city that he understood.
The book really embraces, Larry, the people that inspired the city, as we talked about, to become what it is today. Tell us about Alexander Hemin.
Well, Alexander Hemin is a tremendous writer who immigrated to Chicago from Eastern Europe as a teenager. In the book, I use his novel Nowhere Man as a text that talks about the ways in which Chicago has changed in the last generation. I think the thing that is particularly striking about Hemin's novel is that we use this term globalization in a particular way, typically, and it's the globalization of major corporations and of technology and of the sense that there are these celebrities who are known around the world. There are Beyoncé and so on. And Hemin is talking about a different kind of globalization. It's the globalization of people who are displaced from one part of the world to another, who enter a new society, and their process of existence is learning a new culture and attempting to figure out to what degree they're going to assimilate or possibly not assimilate. And I think that it's the Nowhere Man in particular is a lovely expression of this this globalization or globalism from the bottom up, the way it's experienced by immigrants, the way that it's experienced by people who are not celebrities, the way it's experienced by people who are not connected to Microsoft or Apple.
Now let's jump ahead a little bit and talk about Mike Royko's Chicago. Mike, I mean, just made such an – he was so impactful when you think about the decades that he wrote for the Sun-Times and the Chicago Tribune.
Well, and I think that the thing that I particularly admire about Royko is his sense of humor, the way in which he brought satire to his characterization of real events and real personalities. I read a lot. I'm a college professor, and this book that we're talking about is based on doing a tremendous amount of reading from different kinds of sources about our city. And one of the things that is lovely about encountering Mike Royko is it's literally just fun to read many of his columns because of the particular kind of sense of humor he had.
And his passion for the city.
And his passion for the city, and also his ability to even make fun of himself. The column in which he talks about himself as high-rise man because he's moved into a tall apartment building at that time, and he satirizes anthropologists, but also himself, because I think he had serious misgivings about what he was doing at the time.
Yep, yeah.
One of the things that I do point out in the book, though, is that as he got older, and things happen to people. Things happen to creative people. Things are certainly happening to me as a 65-year-old, I know. He began to come to terms with the city in a way which reduced the sharpness of his critical edge as an observer of the city. And it's a very interesting process in which the not exactly angry young Royko, but the young Mike Royko was very, very pushy in looking at the city and thinking critically about what the leaders of the city were doing and what the impact of urban renewal was, or the way in which the racial conflicts of the 1960s were playing out. And later in his life, he becomes, I think, nostalgic for Chicago. He becomes nostalgic for the city that he grew up in and that he originally wrote about. And so one of the things that I try to do in the book is not so much criticize Royko, but note that if you read the later Royko, you're reading someone who is to some degree projecting the 1950s and the 1960s onto the 1970s and the 1980s. The changes that have occurred in the city are matters that he's uncomfortable with, and he really attempts to retain the older city even as Chicago is changing.
Well, we've only touched the surface of this wonderful, insightful book about our city. It's called The Third City, Chicago and American Urbanism. It's available wherever books are sold. Larry, again, wonderful book. I appreciate you taking the time for us this morning, and enjoy your Sunday.
Well, it was lovely talking with you, and thanks so much for the compliments, and enjoy Sunday, too.
Our pleasure. All right. Dave Schwann joins me for This Week in History, coming up next on 720 WGN.